لبان علي وحسين وحسن.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that is often asked regarding one of the events that is popularly narrated regarding the day of Ashura. This is kind of tied up to the month of Sha'ban. We would like to congratulate our listeners on this most auspicious month, which is the month of Sha'ban, a very blessed month, a spiritual month, and a month of spiritual growth. It's also the month in which we have many holidays, the birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his magnificent brother, Hazrat Abbas, the birth of the 12th Imam alayhi salam. For this, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners. The question that's asked regarding the event of Ashura is whether or not there was actually water present on the day of Ashura. You know, some people say there was, some people say there wasn't. And so the question is asked and people are curious exactly what occurred on this day. Of course, we would like to add the reservation here that according to authentic historical accounts, there was water present until the eve of the day of Ashura. This is attested to by the fact that the son of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Ali Akbar, alayhi salam, said, "O father, my thirst has killed me or has tortured me." In order to respond to this question, we need to return to what's been related in reliable historical texts. According to a lot of reliable historical texts, Ibn Ziyad, Ubaydullah Ibn Ziyad, he gave the order on the 7th of Muharram to Umar Asad that he not allow Imam Hussein to arrive at the Euphrates River, and he didn't want him to even get a drink of water, a drop of water to drink. Umar Asad, when he received this order, he gave the order to Umar ibn Hajjaj to go with 500 horsemen and to watch over the Euphrates River, to not allow Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions to get to the river. In these 3 days, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions tried in various ways to arrive at the river from other directions, because, as you know, they were with children and women and in, you know, the desert, and it was very difficult for them to bear the thirst at this time. According to many other accounts which have been narrated, Imam Hussein also attempted to dig wells in his encampment in order to get water to drink. And when the news of such a thing reached Ibn Ziyad, he was upset, he became angry, and he ordered his soldiers to prevent Imam Hussein from doing such a thing. According to another account which has been narrated, it has been mentioned that the brother of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, alayhi salam, performed a night mission along with 30 horsemen and 20 soldiers, you know, under the, you know, command of Nafi ibn Hilal, they attempted to arrive at the Euphrates River to get some water. They became entangled with the army of Umar ibn Hajjaj, but at the same time, they were successfully able to fill 20 canteens of water and bring them back. Of course, this hasn't been the exact time when this occurred, hasn't been related. Nevertheless, this is something that's been related. According to some other accounts, it has been related that on the day of Ashura, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam told his sister, Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam, that he was soon going to be martyred, his sister, she fainted, and Imam alayhi salam asked for water to be sprinkled on her face so that she could be revived. This account, you know, kind of conveys the idea that there was some water at least present on the day of Ashura. According to certain other accounts, even more water was present. And, you know, these different accounts should be taken into account in order to assess whether, you know, the presence of water or its absence on the day of Ashura. Thank you for joining us on The Key, where we're looking at the presence or absence of water on the day of Ashura. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Races, beauty contests, and a marvelous show. Here is everything you need to know about the first Qatar Camel Festival. Qatar kicked off its very first edition of the Camel Festival earlier this month at Lepsair, Doha. The festival features unique and high-value breeds for the public to enjoy. Camels from all around the region will also get to flaunt their posture to earn the title of the most beautiful camel or the highest value breed in the festival. But first, the whole lot should be judged.
Judging is based on the size of the camel's head, the length of the neck, and the beautiful appearance of the animal and its health status. Of course, judging is different for each group of camels. For example, in the case of camels that are black, the focus is on the size of the animal's head. But on camels that are white, the focus is on the beauty of the camel and the harmony of the body and the beauty of the animal. In addition, we have very experienced professional staff who will deal with the animal if it is artificially beautified.
To spike excitement and competitiveness in those who enjoy such shows, the country has allocated a whopping 47 million Qatari riyals for the lucky winners. The 45-day event will last until March 22nd and will include various competitions, including 115 local and international races.
In the streets of the Chadian capital city, an actor is bringing culture to impoverished neighborhoods by organizing readings of poetry and plays.
Culture should be accessible to all. If we want to have a wonderful world, a harmonious world, everyone should be focused on the same dimensions to be able to dream together. And without culture, we don't be able to initiate development. And to initiate this stage of development, we need to invite people to think together.
The actor does not have a fixed place to tell his stories. He performs in public spaces and says it is his way of giving everyone the opportunity to discover and explore creativity. Among the activities Bonaventure organizes, one can name drawing with children and conducting acting classes. He believes music and theater bring other disciplines together, creating an avenue for enriching human connections. Residents, especially the children of the impoverished neighborhood, say they always look forward to Bonaventure's arrival. A first-of-its-kind selfie museum in the Central American country of Guatemala is gaining lots of attention from excited enthusiasts. The selfie museum is located in Antigua, Guatemala, and is made up of 40 rooms or scenarios. Each room is a recreation of a colorful theme. Wallpaper, wings, greenery, neon signs, and other props are all present to spark the interest of visitors. One room includes a levitating bed, and another is equipped with a spaceship. Other rooms have familiar scenarios of presidential offices and comic book characters for visitors to take photographs in. Several artists participated in creating the art illustrations. A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased three females and one male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The four crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and the United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mongol courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoogh, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoogh's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Persian language has been spoken for three millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
A thousand years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets. Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
In Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The direction they were leading the Ummah towards, every single one of the Imams, is to establish the authority, the government of Allah on earth. And the biggest obstacle in the way of that is the government of Taghut, the rule of Taghut. If the rule of Taghut is removed, we have a recent example too, when authority on the land, on the earth, the entirety of it, the whole globe, was governed by the East and the West after the Second World War. The world was divided between the USSR and the US. These were the two global powers, and they split the world between themselves, and they fought each other in Korea, in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in other countries as well, in South America too. Wherever there was a rebellion against one, the other one would come in and try to take advantage of that. When they were the authorities of the land, of the earth, the name of Islam, the message of Islam, the spirit of Islam, the ahkam of Islam were being forgotten. In the countries where Islam developed and spread from to the rest of the world, the principles of Islam, the ahkam of Islam, were not being taken seriously, and the masses were ignorant. Masses were very ignorant of the rules of Islam. Those who believed in Islam had very little knowledge. There wasn't much being produced, much being published. Those who wanted to speak of Islam were very limited. Not only were they not given resources, God's resources were not given to them to use in the way of God. Whatever resources they could get their hands on were taken away from them. Their liberties were taken away from. They were imprisoned, sent to exile. And then on a global scale, where do we have Islam and people moving towards it? But as soon as in that one corner of the earth, the government of the Ahlul Bayt, the authority of Allah, under the guidance of the Ahlul Bayt, that the Imam said to follow in our absence, follow the mujtahideen that are pious, that have these conditions, and their responsibility is to guide you in the same direction that we did. We move towards establishing the government of God. They should be moving in the same direction. Listen to them under the guidance of one of the descendants of the Prophet, a descendant of Amir al-Mu'mineen, a descendant of Fatimah al-Zahra, a descendant of Imam al-Mujtaba, a descendant of Imam al-Husayn, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. As they themselves had told us this will happen, they had a rebellion against the authority of Taghut in that corner of the world. Once that happened, the spirit of Islam grew. People came to Islam from all corners of the earth. Nobody even sent a messenger to them to deliver the message. They just heard on the news and it inspired them. They found books. They became Muslim. They became lovers of the Ahlul Bayt. Exactly as God has said in the conquest of Mecca, we have got to move towards the global government of the Ahlul Bayt. Any movement, any speech, any organization, any center that doesn't teach this has got at least a slight deviation off the course of the Ahlul Bayt. Any center, any speaker, any so-called scholar that teaches against this, that teaches us to befriend authorities of kufr, to be part of authorities of kufr, to be at peace with the enemies of the religion, the enemies of Islam, the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt, any person, any center, any organization, any country, any whatever site, social media account that promotes that, that's the mouthpiece of shaitan, even if they present themselves as lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, followers of the Ahlul Bayt, Muslimin or whatever. Any voice, under any condition, that uses what Imam Zain al-Abidin did, what Imam al-Sadiq did, what Imam al-Kadhim did, and interprets it in a way where they suggest that means we cooperate with the dhalama, with the oppressors. We work with the oppressors. We accept the oppressors. We join the movement of the oppressors by joining the government on whatever level. We accept them. We admire them. We support them. Any of that is a misinterpretation, deliberate or ignorant. It doesn't matter. It's a misinterpretation of the conduct and the speech of the Ahlul Bayt. And it is, whether it's deliberate or ignorant, is moving people in the direction opposite the direction of the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. This is an important element in the guidance of the Ahlul Bayt. Abul Fadl Abbas is the flag bearer of Karbala for what? What is he standing for? What does that flag represent? It's the flag of the walaya of the Ahlul Bayt. The walaya of the Ahlul Bayt that does not accept the authority of the Yazids and the Muawiyahs and the Mansur al-Dawaniqi and the Harun al-Rashids and the Mutawakkils and the Ma'moons and the Trumps and the Bidens and the Queens of England and the Kings and Queens of Europe and whatever other authority of Kufr and Taghut there is in the world. That's the banner of Imam al-Hussein. That's the standard of Imam al-Hussein. That's the flag of Imam al-Hussein. That's the flag of Karbala that Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas kept up until their hands were cut off, and he was not willing to leave that and drop that flag. And by the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this flag was never put down. Each imam took it to the next imam, and our beloved Imam al-Hujjah ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif is holding this banner high and is moving in that direction and is fighting all the tawaghit, and we can already see his success in the form of the revolution in the Islamic Republic, in the form of Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq, in the form of the Yemeni rise and Muqawama, in the form of the Lebanese Muqawama Hezbollah, in the form of the Syrian Muqawama, in the form of the Afghan and Pakistani and Egyptian and whoever else that we're seeing is making progress. The Palestinian Muqawama against the Zionists that will defeat the Zionists, will remove that taghut, that entity, that illegitimate entity from Palestine. We're seeing the work of the Imam of our time. These are the accomplishments of the Mahdi of Fatima, salamullahi alayha wa ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ruhi lahu al-fida.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Ruhi كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him,
and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salamullah. We are talking about freedom and how Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, saw it important, rather he made it a policy, that people need to be free. They need to have the freedom. He himself was endeavoring his best to provide means for the welfare of people. And at the same time, he was so severe in punishing those criminals who goes against public order and public interest. And in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullahi alayhi, he did not make any discrimination, nor did he try to give others rights above others. Friends and foes were equal in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. And he himself did not have any leniency with anyone, because the truth itself is one. It is not subject to leniency. I have friends, I have cousins, I have relatives, I have, you know, tribesmen. Therefore, I need to be kind to them, I be not nice to them. Even with his own brother, we can see that when history tells us that his brother Aqil came to him asking for extra wealth, he denied. Not that he only denied, but he made it an example for mankind to learn from until the day of judgment, where he burned a metal rod and he puts it in the hand of his brother. When his brother, his hand got burned, he started screaming of pain and agony. And Amir al-Mu'mineen said to him, well, do you want me to burn in hell because you want me to give you the rights of other people? Now, this is the justice that we want. This is the freedom that we want. Therefore, in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, everyone was the same, friends and foes. Ali alayhi salam was confident that his piety was well known to all, and that they were aware that he had no equal in the matter of piety. And he took from the word only as much as was sufficient for him and for his living. And this is something that we all can see when we read the life of the commander of the faithful. He did not take one extra bite more than what he had required, nor did he take an extra dime more than what he had required, or wore or bought clothes more than he had required. This fact of piety of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullahi alayhi, was known to all. The people also knew that the only purpose of his life was to establish truth and to help the needy and the oppressed. This is another fact that no one can deny when looking at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And that he did these things as a matter of duty, not as a matter of trying to show himself as a good character to the people, to society. Rather, was a duty of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and did not show kindness to others based on the fact that he has to compromise on these duties. On the contrary, he was firm into applying these concepts. Now, let us take a short break and we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen's concept of justice and freedom. Before he applies freedom and justice to people, he has to make it known to people that he is a worthy character, a worthy khalif, a worthy ruler to lead them and give them this right. And there was no doubt in the mind of people of his time and today that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam wasn't that. He was that and more. If you look into his life, you see that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam did not like to eat honey because he was afraid that there might be some persons and some people among his subject to whom even barely tasted the taste of honey, or even barley and bread might not be available to him. So he's, in another word, he's saying, how could I be eating honey when people don't even have barley or bread to eat? And he used to sit and wipe and sweep the treasury of the Muslims after he divided them. And then he says, I wonder if there's a hungry person out there. Now, this is what a leader should be. This is what we need as human beings. For a person to establish justice and give people freedom and give them their right in the same way Amir al-Mu'mineen did. And even in our modern day today, none have ever established such concept where they put the rights of others and the needs of others before them. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he never wore fine dresses, because there might be a member of the public who might not be having even a course of a dress to wear. And even today we have many people, when it comes to winter, for example, they haven't got winter clothes. You can see a lot of children around the world, millions of children around the world, don't have clothes to wear. And we can see that this trend, even in the most civilized countries, the most secular countries, you have people below the poverty line who don't have the basic rights and they don't have the basic needs to survive. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, his conduct was different to that of the leaders and the systems that we see today and we saw throughout history. He did not like that people should call him the commander of the faithful and should not partake in their difficulties. So he's like, if you want to call me the commander of the faithful, I have to come to your help. I have to come to your need. Because before him and after him, many people have assumed this name, Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, but they were not the commanders. They were the kings and people, weren't the believers, but they were the servants. He said, if you want to give me that title, I have to live up to it. And no one lived up to that title except for him. And therefore we say it is forbidden for anyone to assume that title except for Ali alayhi as-salam. Because he only, and only he, managed to establish justice and freedom for the people. We will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
Aperture.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we will follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharayi. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Flat waters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadi Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berry's Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berry's village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berry's. The villagers moved from Old Berry's to New Berry's around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berry's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where Old Berry's used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in New Berry's. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course.
Thank you.
The main occupation of the people of Baris is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea.